My name is Glenn Davis, and it's a great pleasure to welcome each of you on behalf of the University to a public lecture of clearly great interest. Before we start, I'd like to acknowledge, of course, the traditional owners of the land in which we meet this evening, the Wurundjeri people of the five Kulin nations, and pay respects to their elders past and present. Tonight, we gather for an annual public lecture which has a long history and I think a growing measure of importance as public debate about the future of the media intensifies. The A.N. Smith Lecture was first held in 1938 as the Second World War approached. The lectures were instituted following a bequest from the family of Arthur Norman Smith, who was the first general president of the Australian Journalists Association and a long-time reporter on Australia's national political scene. From the very first lectures, there's always been a sustained discussion about journalism at this evening's event, the media, the public role, and about their life in our democracy. And while this was an important goal in 1938, it's arguably become even more significant in the decades since. Over the years, the A.N. Smith Lectures have been delivered by a luminous cast of journalistic authorities and other public figures, and of course, that tradition continues. Notable individuals to deliver this A.N. Smith Lecture include News Limited proprietor Rupert Murdoch, former Prime Minister Bob Hawke, former Prime Ministerial speechwriter Don Watson, former Herald and Weekly Times editor and Steve Harris, ABC presenter and subsequent parliamentarian Maxine McHugh, John Fain, the former editor of The Age, who's sitting just over there, Michael Gawenda. Last year's lecture was delivered by the ABC's managing director, Mark Scott, and I think it served to open up some very important national conversation about the replaces of the public and private in the media, and that's a debate that certainly continued. And tonight, we're very fortunate to continue this great tradition of public conversation by inviting another contemporary media voice to take the microphone and deliver the A.N. Smith Lecture in Journalism. Annabel Crabb is certainly well known to many of us from her regular appearances as a commentator on ABC television. Perhaps less well known is that she's also a graduate with arts and law degrees from the University of Adelaide. She undertook a cadetship at the Advertiser in 1997, covering state and then federal politics, and became part of the National Press Gallery in 1999. She joined The Age the following year and worked as a House on the Hill columnist and political correspondent before travelling to the United Kingdom in 2003 to work as London correspondent for the Sunday Age and the Sun Herald newspapers. While in London, Annabel wrote the book Losing It, the inside story of the Labour Party in opposition, which was published in 2005. In 2007, she returned to Australia as a senior writer and political columnist for the Sydney Morning Herald. She joined the ABC in 2009 as chief online political writer and the same year was acknowledged with a Walkley Award for a quarterly essay feature on the life and adventures of Malcolm Turnbull. Amongst her many distinctions, Annabel is one journalist who has successfully made the transition from print to digital media, and I think this equips her particularly well to address us on the intriguing topic of the end of journalism as we know it and other good news stories. Please welcome Annabel Crabb.
Thank you, Glenn, for that introduction, and thank you to Michael Gawenda as well, my favourite former editor. Ladies and gentlemen, the internet nearly ruined my career. And I don't mean that in the hand-wringing, oh my God, what are we going to do about classified revenue sort of a way. I mean it in the, oh my really God, I've just done something so stupid on the internet that I think I'm about to be sacked kind of a way. It was 2001. I was a Canberra-based reporter for The Age. I'd been working there for about 2 weeks, having arrived there from the Canberra Bureau of the Advertiser. My new office was about 20 steps from my old one, but it was a new paper and a new company, and hence a considerable move. My old editor, Mel Mansell, who is still in charge of the Advertiser and who is, I think, now Australia's longest-serving daily Murdoch editor, took my departure well. That is to say, he rang me most days to inform me that my work for The Age was tripe, and that while he couldn't believe I'd gone into harness for such a drippy, pathetic, and even worse, Melbourne-based newspaper, he was nonetheless thrilled to see the back of me. Sometimes, some days, he'd just send me an email identifying the deficiencies in a story that I'd written, or, even better, alerting me to a News Limited version of the story that was superior to mine. I decided to outprank him. A fellow reporter at The Age, I don't want to embarrass him, so let's just call him Jason Katsoukas, showed me a truly diabolical website where you could compose an email that appeared to come from any email address that you nominated. All you did was type in the address of the recipient and then the address you wanted it to look like it came from, you know, bill.clinton@whitehouse.gov or whatever. So I typed in my old editor's address in the recipient field, and then in the author's field, I typed in an artfully altered but still nonetheless plausible email address for my new editor-in-chief at The Age. And then, so help me God, I typed the message. Mansell, stop bothering my fine new Canberra recruit, whom I consider to be an ornament to journalism. Having rescued her from your two-bit laughable excuse for a newspaper, I would now be much obliged if you would cease your grubby attempts to malign her. She's out of your league, Squire. You hear me, Mansell? Yours sincerely, Michael Gawenda. P.S. If you see me coming, you better run. And then I sent it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, because you are cleverer than I, you will no doubt have recognised the recklessness of my enterprise. Perhaps you will already have twigged that Fairfax, even in those days, had an email system that would take an educated guess at redirecting a message in circumstances when the address was a little bit garbled, and that this would make it possible for a former editor, having received an email that appeared to be from a current editor but was in fact assembled out of mischief in the twinkling and magical expanse of the then still novel World Wide Web, to hit reply and have that reply, along with its humiliating original, zing back, not as planned, back into the ether whence it came, but with a horrible accuracy, right into the inbox of aforementioned new employer. Ladies and gentlemen, I tell this story for a reason, and no, by the way, I didn't get the sack. My host's twinkly benevolence is not a disguise. He spared my miserable neck. I want to talk to you tonight about digital media and the future of journalism. And it's a subject on which many smart people know lots of useful things. I don't want to be accused of giving myself airs. And I can't be now that I've already told you the dumbest thing I've ever done. So 1 year ago, I decided to leave newspapers and take up life as an online writer. It's not that I didn't love my job, I did. In fact, I firmly believe that my job at the Sydney Morning Herald was about the most fun job available in newspapers. I wasn't sick of my round, federal politics. I wasn't sick of my colleagues. I was not embezzling petty cash. Nor indeed was I about to be exposed publicly for my earlier experiments with online identity theft. I'm not a tech head either. This is one of the special bonds I share with Tony Abbott, as well as being hopeless at ironing. My relationship with information technology hardware is one of intense mutual suspicion, flaring into occasional acts of violence. I once baked an Apple MacBook in the oven. I'm not even joking about that. On the night that I saw Kevin Rudd assassinated by his deputy, I was rushing to pile two sleeping children into the car at midnight to drive to Canberra, and I dropped my new iPhone into a full bath of water. For the next 2 days it worked, but only on speakerphone, so I apologise for anybody whose anonymity I threatened. So like most journalists, I really can't be trusted around sophisticated equipment, and I still write stuff on my hand. I left newspapers because it seemed like all of a sudden it was a good time to take a risk. At Fairfax, where internecine warfare still rages around the control of the websites, it felt as though an absurd structural roadblock was obstructing a great company's adaptation to the new media environment. And at the ABC, a group of enthusiastic executives, Mark Scott, Kate Tawney, Gavin Morris among them, was embracing the new terrain with vigour. We're all, especially those of us who love newspapers, exhaustedly aware of the threats that exist. I want in this speech to talk about the opportunities and the experience of making the leap. I can still remember when my newspaper first got the internet. It was 1998, and I was a cadet. And in the police rounds room, where I worked the 4 p.m. till midnight shift, there in a corner was the brand spanking new desktop computer, which had the internet on it. Just the one terminal for the whole newspaper. And there it sat, like a freshly ditched meteorite in a Kalahari bush camp. Not many of us actually touched this weird apparatus. Every now and again, a senior journo would walk past, give it a kick, and say something like, "I'd like to see this thing ever give me a yarn." That was 12 years ago. We get so preoccupied by the threats of the internet that we forget how bizarrely object-dependent we used to be before its invention, when getting hold of a government report meant cycling across town to get it, often to pay for it, if you can imagine that. When working on a Sunday meant a total information blackout, with no access to public service information, and when foreign newspapers were totally inaccessible, apart from the two-week-old Guardian, which might turn up from time to time for 5 minutes on the news floor before being pilfered. These days, I write for The Drum, which is the comment and analysis portal on the ABC's website. It's been going for less than a year, but readership's growing fast. 4.5 million page views in the first quarter of this year for The Drum Unleashed, 9 million in the third quarter. Life is pretty different. I have two little kids, not because of the internet, I hasten to clarify. They happened anyway. I work from home much of the time, and now that I don't have a 7 p.m. deadline anymore, I can file whenever I like, often late at night. I file directly to my editor, Jonathan Green, and it can be posted in minutes. I don't even have a desk at the ABC. I have an iPad with its weird little keyboard, and I just take a seat wherever I happen to be working. I used to have a total midden of a desk when I worked in newspapers, and I find that the abolition of the desk has really helped with the mess. Although, I have to admit, my home office is still a bit of a tip. So my word length is anywhere between 3 words and 3,000. I file when I feel like I've got something to say, and if it's short, I'll say it on Twitter. My main account in my own name has about 24,000 followers, and I use it mainly for news, or sharing links to stories, or comments on news events as they happen, or pointers to especially delicious recipes. My other Twitter account, Crab Twitzard, is the one that I set up for live tweeting question time. Mainly I set up a second account as a courtesy thing, because if I use the bigger account to churn out tweets every 20 seconds about what's going down in the House of Representatives, I tend to get accused of spamming, and that's fair enough. So the Crab Twitzard account is kind of a special one strictly for the hardcore nerds. I use it as a sort of a notebook. I send out the thoughts that first occur to me, and later I might develop a column out of the whole. The feedback I get during question time often gives me ideas that I wouldn't have had by myself. In between writing, I talk to ABC Radio all over the country. I do insiders every couple of weekends, spots on ABC News 24 when they need me, and of course our Drum TV show, which is doing very well at 6 p.m. on weekdays on News 24. And during the election campaign, I was fortunate enough to be involved with another terrific program, Gruen Nation. So, what's different about working online, if you'll excuse me briefly interrogating myself in the style of a certain immediate past Prime Minister? Well, the first thing I noticed was the immediacy of the viewer response, the reader response, and the vigour. In the old days, readers who thought you were an idiot would probably curse, gesticulate with a soldier of toast to their long-suffering spouse, explain to the for the umpteenth time to said long-suffering spouse that that crab woman's an idiot, and then move on to read something sensible by Peter Harcher. Let's suppose that of the, say, 40% of readers who thought you were an idiot, 10% got past the toast gesticulation and said, "You know what, I'm going to tell that woman she's an idiot." And maybe 10% of them actually got round to finding your address. And maybe 10% of them actually got round to writing a letter. And maybe 10% of them made it to the mailbox. So at the end, you'd get maybe one letter, usually identifiable by the trademark flourishes of the obsessive, random underlining, the stern refusal to be silenced by the mere fact that the paper has run out. A truly determined correspondent, in my experience, finding himself at the end of a page will simply go up the side. Online, however, you get the kitchen table response. Straight away, right in the kisser. Make a comment, suggests the tag at the end of the ABC stories, and ABC online readers do. Oh yes, my word, they do. and so do the denizens of the Twitter sphere. One of the funniest moments I've had was my first day back from work after the abrupt end of my maternity leave occasioned by Julia Gillard's most inconsiderate announcement of an election. I raced into Ultimo on Saturday morning, doing my own hair and makeup with the skill and dexterity that only a long-term print journalist can manage. And when I was finished with my live television cross, I found a fusillade of commentary waiting for me on Twitter. "You will never be taken seriously," wrote one correspondent in a direct message, "until you do something about your ridiculous hair." Now, the correspondent's name, by the way, was Harry underscore Ballsack. I did want to reply, but I struggled for appropriate words. "Dear Mr. Ballsack, thank you for your tweet of 10 minutes ago." In the end, I maintained what I like to think was a dignified silence. It can be quite maddening being publicly shellacked by people who have clearly only read half of what you've written, or have never read anything else you've ever written, or just hate you anyway, or just having a terrible day and taking it out on you. And as a writer reading those comments, you feel terribly outraged and sinned against, until you take a tiny moment to reflect that this is how politicians feel every day when we sort through their efforts with a similarly jaundiced eye. What's worse is when you read the responses from people who have clearly read the whole article, aren't mental, really quite seriously think you are a loser, and whose argument is so compelling that by the end of it, you feel quite obliged to agree. Both of these discomforting instances are part and parcel of the new media landscape. It's what happens when the system is democratised. News journalism, as we've known it in the past, a sort of a daily feeding time in which news is distributed to a passive audience at a designated hour and in the order selected by the zookeeper, is over, or well on its way to being so. Audiences are splintered but demanding. They want new news, and if something complicated has happened, they want instant analysis, and commonly they want an opportunity to express their own views, not only on the event itself, but on how it's been reported. Once you yield up your content into this new matrix, it's not the end of the matter anymore. Time to pack up and go to the pub and watch while your work describes a brief arc of significance before becoming home to an oily catch of flathead and chips. News is no longer about newspapers or journalists or radio bulletins delivering chunks of news and that being the end of it. It's much more likely to be the beginning of something, something you can't much control after pressing send. And this loss of control is such a hallmark of the new media. And that's true for everybody it touches. Never before have public figures been forced to grapple with such a wholesale loss of control over image or message or identity. Even presently anonymous citizens are now only one viral email away from global humiliation. Public figures, having generated a public identity, find that the more they try to control it, the less successful they are in so doing. Andrew Bolt, on discovering the existence of a fake Andrew Bolt on Twitter, issued forth such a howl of dismay that within a day there were 30 of them. Among politicians, the situation is enough to induce the vapours in even the hardiest. Any blooper now, rather than being news for a day, can be replayed endlessly and on demand on YouTube, depending on how funny or weird or gross it is. Kevin Rudd eating his own earwax continues to be a curiosity, a phenomenon he could not possibly have imagined all those years ago when peckishness overcame him without warning during a quiet moment in the House of Representatives. And how could Hillary Clinton possibly have foreseen accepting a welcoming kiss from a young girl after disembarking her aircraft in Bosnia in 1996, that the absence of sniper fire from the footage of her arrival would prove an intense political embarrassment to her 12 years later, and that YouTube would brand her a liar? But for journalists, the loss of control is about the loss of centrality. We are, belatedly and for reasons entirely unassociated with government-led deregulation or any of the other usual reasons, contestable. The community of news and commentary is getting stronger and more populous. We're just not necessarily automatically at the heart of it anymore. And we're open to criticism, some of it savage, some of it worryingly accurate, like never before. Our passive, profitable audience is disappearing, And in newspapers, which is where I come from, the panic's about advertising, of course, and how to monetize content online. Here we are in part victims of our own excitement and impulsiveness. At the end of the last century, when newspaper editors and executives began to recognize the potential of the internet, the race was on to win eyeballs online. We piled everything we could onto the net. Over the years, we accustomed ourselves to the idea of breaking news stories online rather than holding them back from the print edition. Build an audience, the theory went, and later on we'll figure out a way to charge them. And 10 years later, what do we have? Leading news websites and an audience which has been trained to expect this stuff for free. In the past, you always paid for journalism. You used to pay for it by stumping up tuppence, then 25 cents, then much later a dollar or two for your paper. And you've always paid for the ABC, of course, through your taxes. And thank you. But you also paid through advertising, which was a ghostly and magical implicit subsidy calculated from the tiny increment by which, after reading the lifestyle section, you felt more inclined to purchase a jumper from David Jones. What a fabulous and random calculation that is. And how odd it is now to witness the garment rending among some sectors of the media industry about the dislocation of this funny old system and the fear that we shall never find another way of funding content. As I said, we've trained readers to expect news online for free, which has had the unintended effect to some extent of devaluing the actual product. And I use this bald term intentionally. Thanks to the expectation inculcated by us in readers that they should enjoy unmetered access to the work of most major newspapers, we journalists are in rather a novel industrial position. 6.5 million people will pay between 99 cents and $4.99 to download the iPhone app Angry Birds, in which the player assists a group of enraged avian characters to revenge themselves upon some animated green pigs for the crime of egg theft. No one seems to have a problem with that tariff. Games designers have to eat, and so on. Yet mention the prospect of a charge to read an article on the Times of London's website, and it's an entirely different matter. Why does this disparity exist? Why is my intellectual property suddenly worthless, while the guy who invents hilarious ringtones is somehow still entitled to the customary presumption that his day's work warrants some sort of commensurate recompense? The answer is that we journalists have already ceded the field. We've already given our stuff away. I can still remember when I got the cheque from News Limited for the copyright to my articles when published online. What was it, $400? Something like that. Good deal. All of this is changing, but let's take a nostalgic moment to discuss the market proposition that is journalism. What are you buying? I don't mean indirectly. Under the old system of cross-subsidisation with its hilariously accidental premise, I mean in direct terms. If you had to pay for each article, what would you be paying for exactly? When you buy the work of a journalist, you're buying the time and the research and the writing. But there's more than that. You're buying a fraction of the 10 hours that that journo spent hanging around on the night that Kevin Rudd was knocked over talking to people when you were very sensibly asleep. You're taking out a timeshare on all the stuff that that journo remembers, an infinitesimal slice of the mistakes they've made and what they learned from them. You're buying a tiny shred of the moment when Laurie Oakes got leaked the whole budget, or a millionth of a sesame seed on the bread roll of the lunch that Laurie deserted on the day of the Whitlam dismissal to sprint back to old Parliament House. Yes, that happened. You're compensating that journo to a tiny degree for the 10-minute bollocking she just copped from Paul Keating or Malcolm Turnbull or the CEO of some company. And in the case of the very best and most fearless journos, you're insuring them against the fact that they will never work in this town again. Now, I can understand the argument that information in an ideal world should be free, but I'm also familiar with free information. Free information is usually free for a reason. Mostly it's free because it's a press release, or an ad, or it's been nicked from TMZ.com, or because it's so incredibly banal that even its creator can't bear to look you in the eye and shake you down for cash. Free information, ladies and gentlemen, tends to be crappy information. Good information is expensive, and it's expensive because somebody who knows what they're doing has put some serious time into finding it out for you, or put themselves in harm's way, or is sticking his or her neck out in some way to get it to you. Good information is usually expensive because there's someone somewhere who doesn't want you to have it. good information in newspapers is additionally expensive because it's weighed down with all the pricey accessories of the print game, all those trucks, all those highly strung German printing presses. So here we are. It's a rather hairy little equation on the whole. We generate a commodity that is expensive to produce, but we've talked people out of paying for it. It's no use mooning about and fantasising about how the clock can be turned back or how readers can somehow be tricked into coughing up for what they now read at no charge. Having put the cart before the horse in the first instance, it seems that newspapers now often make the same mistake again in trying to get out of the mess, trying to work out how to charge for the content before working out how you make the content worth charging for. Sounds like we're hitching our horse right back up to the arse end of the cart again. In such a panic about how to make money that the larger questions, how will we be relevant, how can we be useful, often are overlooked. The only way is to offer something new, something worth paying for. Apps for mobile and tablet devices are the obvious vehicle, but it's no good just dumping the copy from the newspaper onto some cigarette packet-sized mega computer and holding out your hand. Here's a good rule of thumb, I reckon, for paid content. If you're already doing it, don't charge for it. If it's something new, make it worth charging for. The erosion of the old system's predictability, and in particular the gathered audiences that made advertising a piece of cake to sell, do tend to inspire a rather apocalyptic feel among some sections of what they call the legacy media. But I take a cheerier view. What lies ahead isn't a blasted heath, it's just a building site, that's all. And technology gives us everything we need to build something extraordinary to replace what we used to do, so long as we're prepared for it to look completely different, and as long as we no longer assume ourselves to be the only people qualified to create content. There are incredible opportunities in place. For one, we're officially no longer running out of readers. And that's good news. For decades in the print game, we've fretted about our ageing readership, scrambling to keep them alive with healthy liver lift-outs and guides to sensible exercise, while silently resenting their flighty offspring, who we couldn't induce to buy the paper no matter how many desperate, yo, you've in the house, sections we commissioned. But online is where they all are. They'll self-select themselves on the basis of their interests. Sure, they're not gathered passively in one place anymore, but they're online and handily traceable through their interests and consumption patterns thanks to the rank outrages against personal privacy occasioned by the social media giants of our age. So hooray for that. Two, there is a workforce of young journalists and writers who have been trained to think laterally, not by cadet coaches and shorthand teachers as of yore, but by the sheer Darwinian demands of the current jobs market in journalism. Three, there's an abundance of space for experimentation. No longer will news and advertising struggle for space on the same page in that strange fight to the death between content and its own lifeline that has been such a feature of newspaper and publishing to date. This is great news for journalists because it means no longer being bumped for ads. Four, there's an exponential improvement in the ease of online transactions. Micropayments, in which paying 5 cents for a story does not involve fumbling about for your credit card or exposing your vital details to some lurking online fraudster, are becoming easier and easier. Five, there's an incredible potential for using different techniques to beckon audiences into news. Let's take politics and the example of Jon Stewart's Daily Show in the United States. Stewart, a satirist, deconstructs US politics nightly on Comedy Central and offers a sharply observed analysis in the form of an opening routine followed by an interview with some author, policymaker or politician, often the sort of person who would struggle to win the attention of an orthodox chat show. The Daily Show is seen by an estimated audience daily in the States of 3.5 million. The Time magazine's online poll last year identified Stewart, stunningly, as America's most trusted news identity. And finally, when we ask ourselves what's important to news and current affairs consumers, I suspect we'll find that the factor which is currently freaking us out so much, this proliferation of content, this babble of chatter, this splintering of audiences, is exactly where we can prove useful in the future. There's a market in making sense of things. The problem for the hungry online consumer has become, with vertiginous speed, not where can I find news, but how do I hack my way through all this stuff to find what I want? When I worked at the Advertiser years ago, I remember meeting a dear old lady who actually said to me, "Isn't it amazing the way that there's always just exactly enough news to fill the paper every day?" And I guess it did look like that to the casual observer. News journalism, as always, if we're honest with ourselves, had two roles. Breaking news is one, and sorting news is the other. An analysis comes in after that. We tend to go on and on about breaking news because it's the exciting bit and the bit that we big note ourselves about down at the pub. But what if the sorting bit turned out to be just as important to the consumer? What if the greatest service we can offer to a reader is a reliable pointer to what's worth a look, both in our own mastheads and others? Reliability and trust become more important the greater the proliferation of information sources. John Hartigan, CEO of News Limited and a man who has spent more time than most grappling with this situation, made quite an epochal speech earlier this year on the subject. "First, we have to get over ourselves and recognise that this is an opportunity, not a threat," he declared. Well, thank God for that. And I know we at the ABC are generally supposed to be having a little skirmish with Team Rupert at the moment, but please permit me to boot a footy over into no man's land for a brief moment to observe that Mr. Hartigan is a valuable leadership figure and an optimist about journalism's capacity to reinvent itself in an exciting way. And the industry needs more media executives like him who are prepared to lead publicly and relish change rather than glumly await the fate of the existing medium. Now, the ABC is presently run by another great optimist, Mark Scott, whose changes to the broadcaster would never have been imaginable 10 years ago. The creation of News 24, the creation of ABC Open, which is an amazing site, by the way, the delivery of ABC content through apps, iView, and endless social networking sites, all these are the work of an organisation that it's a thrill to work for. If you want to gauge the managing director's attitude to his own outfit, we'll follow him on Twitter. The unmistakable enthusiasm for ABC TV, radio and online content sends a powerful message. He is a media executive who actually consumes his own stuff and loves it. It sounds simple, but I mention these things because leadership in public comments, in private behaviour, in decisiveness and enthusiasm can make such a difference to people who are working under stress and uncertainty. Life's too short not to work with enthusiasts, and I've been lucky enough to have them around me all through my career. Friends and colleagues whose energy and imagination is contagious. Jim Middleton, who showed me that a fascination with political reporting can be for life. Sam Maiden, who made online daily reporting of politics in Australia into a competitive field. Photographers like Mike Bowers and the irrepressible Andrew Mears, who never stop thinking of amazing things to do with pictures. Or senior colleagues like Laurie Oakes, who demonstrate that you are never too important to tweet. I could mention dozens of people, and many of them are my new workmates at the ABC, which at times seems to run on enthusiasm. But here's another secret about working online. It's fun. The great joy and fulfilment about working online is a very human one. It's the thrill of calling out and hearing an answering voice, of getting in touch with the funny, smart people out there who think of things that you didn't, who read your analysis and come back with an idea or a criticism that sends you off down another line of inquiry, who send you jokes that are funnier than your own and that, after a decent period has elapsed, you can pass off as your own. Who make criticisms of your work that cause you to think about what you've got wrong and try harder to get it right. For such a long time now, the critique of journalism has been such a closed shop. We've been each other's adjudicators. So-and-so missed the story, that yarn's old, I broke that last year. When an outsider, be it a reader, a politician, or the subject of a story, criticised us, we often circled the wagons. Arguments about journalism were only open to practitioners and journalism academics, a cosy circle of reinforcement. Now they're open to everybody. This was strikingly demonstrated by this year's federal election campaign, in which the news-consuming public were let in on more of the news process than ever before. ABC News 24 and Sky brought you press conferences live so you could watch the whole thing, questions included, and not just the bowdlerised version at the end of the day. I've been to a million of those press conferences, but to watch them live on television as an anonymous member of a TV audience was at times an uncomfortable experience that caused me to question my own approaches and my own news judgments. And when the celebrated Mr. Grogs Gummit tapped out his protest, it was picked up, circulated, and heard in a way that an anonymous blogger would never have been 5 years ago. Otto von Bismarck gave us the warning about the advisability of watching sausages or laws being made, and we've traditionally been equally protective about letting people into our methods. But I think that's yesterday's caution. Why shouldn't people watch how journalists work? Why shouldn't they see how a story develops? Why shouldn't they be permitted a view on whether our methods are reasonable or not? To start out as a journalist in this roiling time of change must be a bracing experience. 13 years ago when I started out, it was a question of finding a job and then getting published. These days, the situation is kind of reversed. It's not just a matter of sitting tests for cadetships or jobbing at a regional paper or radio station until you've earned your stripes. The way into journalism is harder, I think, now in that respect. But in other respects, it's more exciting. Young writers are rewarded for their talent, imagination, and intrepidity in a way that the old structures rarely allowed. When I helped to judge the Walkley Young Journalist of the Year online category a few months back, the evidence was there to see. One young journo had taken himself off to Iran to report on the elections there. One had assembled an incredibly moving narrative map of the Victorian bushfires, incorporating beautiful visuals and design, first-person interviews, and a completely new approach to disaster reporting. One had taken some research about how a parent's hard living as a youth affects the health of future progeny and turned it into a multi-part television comedy. The breadth of ideas present in that cohort was incredible. And the woman who was named Young Journalist of the Year is a case in point. Latika Burke, a radio journalist with Fairfax Radio, is in many ways a classic young Canberra journalist. Hungry, obsessed with politics, pushy, keen, seemingly at work 24 hours a day. But she's taken that radio platform and pushed it further, providing a reliable Twitter feed of events in Canberra, building a Twitter following of nearly 10,000, and interacting with that audience. Fortune favours the brave and the energetic in this market. As I said earlier, I am quite an enthusiast for Twitter. I like Facebook, and I'm aware that it's a massively significant social network, but I find it too demanding to keep up and have now succumbed pathetically to Facebook fear. I cannot visit my Facebook page because of the weight of unanswered messages there. It's my new messy desk. Twitter, however, is less demanding of time. There's a lovely generosity about it. Millions of people pushing little thoughts and fragments into the world, most of which disappear without trace, and some of which whip up into quite significant moments of community. Of all the new social networking phenomena, none is so routinely disparaged as the House of the 140 characters. And before I started using it regularly, I felt exactly the same way. What? A medium invented so that someone I barely know can acquaint me with the details of what they had for lunch? Spare me. But 18 months into my relationship with this new toy, I now realise that declaring Twitter to be fatuous is as nonsensical as to swear off pencils or paper. Like any medium, it just depends what you do with it. Of the 70% of tweets that disappear without trace, most of them are the what I had for lunch kind. But according to Twitter founder Evan Williams, of the 90 million tweets sent daily around the world by Twitter's 145 million users, 2.5 million of whom are in Australia, 25% of those messages contain links. And it's the links, whether on Twitter or Facebook or MySpace or any other platform where people congregate in these new communities, which provide the pollination for news content. For these communities, it doesn't make a lick of difference whether the article being shared is on abc.net.au or theage.com.au or salon.com or clubtropo.com.au. What matters is whether it's worth reading. And I think there's a compelling new quality agenda here. If someone you trust tells you it's worth reading, and if you happen to have the time, then maybe you'll click through and have a look. At their best, these social networks can function like a newspaper put together by your friends, full of stuff they know you'll like. One of the highlights of Fridays is Lee Sales's well-read-head column for me, a list of 10 things she's read in the last week, which she publishes both at The Drum and at The Punch, in a nicely bipartisan gesture, I think. I always look at it because I know that she and I often like the same stuff, and reading her column is like having a chat with her, only I can do it anytime. But social media can work as a fast-track source of news, tips, and research too. I have a moment I treasure from the 2010 election campaign. I treasure it, among many treasured moments, of course. I was out at the Rooty Hill public question and answer session with Julia Gillard and Tony Abbott, which was being broadcast live on Sky News. I was sending out a live call of the event on Twitter. A young man stepped up to the microphone and asked Tony Abbott a question. Rather easy question. 5 seconds later, a Twitter user in Adelaide messaged me to say she thought she recognised the young man as the son of a former Liberal state politician. She couldn't remember his name. Hang on, she told me, I'll phone my friend and check. 30 seconds later, she came back to me with the name and the further information that the young man had been an early Big Brother candidate as well as being a young Liberal. Within about 2.5 minutes of the young man's arrival at the microphone, we knew who he was, where he came from, and the fact that he had once dressed as a priest to pick up girls. Now, you're right, it's not Watergate, but it's a demonstration of how fast the information pool can form. And pooling information is what we've always done, isn't it? Collecting bits from here and there, whacking them together, using judgment and experience to create the most accurate story possible. In the week before Election Day, I put out a call to any Twitter users who are planning to staff polling booths or work as scrutineers at local booth counts. I asked them to supply their real names, electorates, and phone numbers to me. We called them the Scruti Army, in a tribute to the Rooty Hill alumni. And on Election Day and well into the night, they kept up a constant feed of tales from the front. Photos of Liberal and Labor canvassers dressed up as Greens. There was a lot of that. Everyone was dressing as a Green at the ballot box this year. Running accounts of stuff-ups and progressive counts from marginal seats and the odd amusing detail about ornate donkey votes discovered in the piles. Incidentally, there was also a very strong response to our ancillary call for Twitter pictures of election-themed cakes. And I'm proud to say that the baker of the best cake, a young lady I met through Twitter called Sabine Wolfe, is here tonight. Her cake, a House of Reps chamber complete with jelly baby MPs updated through the night, was a total triumph. Human contact is still the key, as it always was. It's through talking to people that you get the ideas, the tip-offs, the good steers. None of these devices will give you everything you need to be a good journalist. No device ever did. But great journalism starts with knowing your community, and smart journalism will change with it. Speaking of communities, I would like to close with a few dreams of my own for this new paradigm before us. My first dream is that we could put an end to the old media, new media wars. Seriously, everyone could calm down a bit and the world wouldn't end. By the second week of the Grog's Gamut skirmish, Grog Gate? Really? It felt like the crucial scene from Spartacus. Do we not have anything more actually outrageous to fight about? Does everything have to turn into the world of Warcraft, with paragons of evil and saintliness at either end and nothing in between? To my colleagues in the mainstream media on the subject of online journalism, I would say, don't knock it till you've tried it. And to the blogosphere, I would say, don't knock us when we try it. That's all. My second dream, and I'll make this quick, even though my actual dream is quite elaborate, with all sorts of occasional features like Bob Catter riding a water buffalo. Oh no, hang on, that's my other dream. Is that we keep in mind how draining the 24-hour news cycle is to the political process. That we use all of this extra space for a proper examination of the ideas on offer. That we give the polling a rest occasionally, for instance. Honestly, how can we expect politicians to lessen their dependence on polling when we're so addicted to the stuff ourselves? There's another whole speech to be written about that stuff. But if we want politicians to be courageous, then we need to reward political courage, not excavate it. I've said enough. This has been a big enough chunk of the 24-hour news cycle already. Thank you to Michael Gawenda for not sacking me 9 years ago. Thank you to the University of Melbourne for inviting me to speak here tonight. After the big game fish who have occupied this podium before me, it's very good of you to solicit the thoughts of a minnow. And because online never sleeps, this speech will be up at abc.net.au/thedrum in minutes. I'd like to hear what you think.
to stay here.
Well, thank you, Annabelle. We're going to take some questions now from the audience. But before we do, I just want to say two little things. One, that would Annabelle have been any less talented than we knew she was? She would have got sacked. And in fact, there were people in the team that urged us to sack Annabelle. But the majority felt that she clearly was going to be a star and there was no way we could sack her. The second thing I'd say is that I don't believe that Laurie Oakes ran to Parliament House. I was actually in the Sun Bureau working with Laurie at the time, and I can't recall in 3 years Laurie ever moving out of his chair in the Bureau, so it must have been somebody else that was running, Annabelle, I think. So we'll take some questions now. I think if you go up to the microphones, or put your hands up, and the microphone will come to you, is that right? And please ask questions, if you can, or make statements of 140 characters.
Okay. I just wanted to ask, I understand that, you know, you want to put an end to the old media, new media wars, and I do appreciate the proliferation of online media and the access that it gives, but I'm also concerned that our appetite for this instant news also sacrifices the quality, and having very brief updates all the time, you know, how are we going to get that analysis when the newspapers are trying to compete with short online articles and then the newspapers are dumbing down? And yeah, so how do we reconcile this transition to new media and still having quality old media?
Yeah, I think that's a huge question. I think the answer is that journalists are learning to do different things at different speeds all the time. I mean, in the last year or so, I mean, I've ranged from being on Twitter incessantly to, you know, writing a 35,000 word essay. You know, you need to sort of set your own speed on these things. And I think that all journalists are coming to terms with these new demands. You know, the deadlines aren't the same as they were. Look, I think it's possible. I mean, moderation in all things is the answer to a lot of these questions, I think. Just as people who scoff at social media or instant sort of platforms say, well, that's ridiculous, you can't live only off those sources, you can't absorb news only from those platforms. I totally agree with that. I think you need a spread. And that is kind of following the pattern of the way audiences work now. They're not all just sort of gathered in one area, passively receiving news. Everybody is tailoring the way that they take in news. And I think that the people who create and disperse news have to deal with it in the same way, pitch everything at a whole lot of different levels.
Is that right? Yeah. I agree with you about the democratisation being really exciting, and but I feel that recently coverage has been really superficial, particularly political coverage, and I find that politicians can get away with saying one thing one day, another thing the next day, and it might get pointed out, but it kind of is forgotten. And, you know, I think the rise of the Tea Party in America, where they really make no sense and somehow they get away, I'm just really hoping that that the exciting elements, can you see sort of how there might be an evolution of these exciting democratisation and might actually then become a little bit more an opportunity for a bit more lengthy and reasoned sort of reflection as well?
Well, I think that that's the responsibility of every journalist that is working in the field today. And, like, there is something very harum-scarum about the present mood. You know, there's anxiety about what's going to happen. There's sort of all these opportunities. There's all this air to fill all of a sudden. And so, and plus there's the ongoing anxiety about, you know, being seen to be balanced and not to be a cheerleader, which is something that, you know, most journalists, I think, take really seriously. And so when you've got so much territory to cover and so many deadlines to meet, so much content to pump out, I suppose, your way of dealing with the balance requirements is to say, well, this person said that and that person said that, you know, which people call, you know, ping pong reporting or whatever, you know. And the challenge, I think, is to actually forego some of that and focus on things that are more in depth and try and deliver a better discussion about the actual policy on offer. You know, I mean, I think that we are in a kind of a state of flux at the moment as journalists try to rush to meet all these demands. I think that one of the trends that will happen over the long term is that you end up having these sort of pots of more specialised reporters who put out copy on particular issues, who are better informed about those issues and are more confident to offer an opinion or a long-sighted analysis in those areas. I think that will be part of the shakeout, and I really hope so too, because I know what you mean, and I think that that's a frustration I hear all the time. And I hope that with News 24 on the ABC, for instance, you know, I know that there is a lot of institutional oversight about how that has an impact on the process. I think that my own fear about political reporting is that we kind of create all these new spaces and then we demand that politicians fill them, and then we're kind of dissatisfied with the incredible pap they come out with obligingly. You know, these people have got to have a bit of a moment to think, but they can't because we're constantly, you know, asking them to be on some back and forth kind of show. And I think that's all, you know, part of the challenge that is inherent in this exciting series of developments.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you something about how you structure your day. You have just spoken about it a little, but as you have thousands of followers and they're constantly pitching in, how much of it do you decide to read and deal with? I know, for example, somebody like Robert Fisk writing in Beirut says he doesn't go online till the afternoon because he actually wants to get his interviews done. And I wondered if you decide, well, I'm only going to read 10 minutes worth and then move on, or...
Oh, I'm definitely a grazer. I'm a grazer. I have it sort of going and I'll check every now and again. And I mean, I do actually derive a lot of, not only enjoyment, but, you know, a lot of ideas from the interactions I have with people online. And, you know, that's just easily the best fun part of my job, is just getting to meet people who I wouldn't ordinarily... I couldn't possibly meet that many people ordinarily on a daily basis. But you find yourself exchanging, you know, the kind of... opinions that might ordinarily take you 20 minutes or 3 hours of conversation to get around to. There's something very economical about these new platforms. You know, all of a sudden you're swapping these quite weird, kind of weirdly intense views or discussions with this person who you've never met and you aren't likely to. So I don't tend to ration my exposure to that too much. I get up, you know, I have two tiny children, so I get up at, you know, 5:30 or whatever, and then I just sort of silence them with food, and then I might kind of have a quick dip into the morning's media. I'll have a look at what's in the papers. I'll have a look at what's happened overnight overseas, and then I'll, you know, feed kids, clean up, go up to work for a little bit and get some phone calls done, plan the day, and then... So I sort of dip in and out of those media over the course of the day, and then I'm always sort of on the phone to radio networks and so on, and, like, all of that is part of the process. You know, I find as a journalist you have so many more ideas when you talk to your colleagues or you talk to anyone, really, I mean, than you ever do when you're just sort of hanging around by yourself. And I think all of these platforms give me a greater opportunity to have those interactions, which generates the ideas. I mean, it's that's for me the excitement of it, I think.
Hi. I'm interested in your thoughts on the role of satire in journalism. It's obviously becoming a lot more important, and, you know, particularly with younger people, it's the way that important news is being distributed. During the last election, I pretty much got all my important news from Gruen Nation and The Chasers and Twitter, and I know a lot of other people who are the same.
Yep, I think that's absolutely the case.
Be funny to be noticed? I mean, is
well,
straight
it's
up just too difficult now?
I think that, you know, it comes about when you have a community, and I think this is true of a lot of younger people that don't buy newspapers and never have, and are absolutely alive to spin, cynicism, strategy, not only in politics but in media too. And I think that satire is an ideal way of getting those people kind of involved and engaged in politics is my field, obviously, so that's what I'm interested in. That's why I'm fascinated by John Stewart, who is kind of an incredibly interesting news figure, because what he does satirically in the opening to The Daily Show, for instance, is he presents an analysis of the day's news events, which can be shorter than simply retelling what's happened, because he uses satire in such a pointed way. He'll perhaps he'll counterpose somebody's statement today with some video of them saying exactly the opposite, you know, 2 years ago. And so he doesn't really editorialise so much as contextualise. And by making it funny and engaging and incredibly sharp, but at the same time making it very well researched, he's able to, I think, provide political analysis that's sharper than that's available in a lot of the newspapers. I mean, I think that absolutely accounts for the appeal of that medium. That and the fact that it appeals to people who are already feeling cynical about the process. And, you know, programs like Gruen Nation and Gruen Transfer, you know, by educating people about what goes on behind the scenes of the product that you finally see, encourages that kind of cynicism. I think it's a healthy cynicism. I don't think there's anything wrong with people knowing what goes on behind, you know, what they're presented with. But I do think satire is an incredibly important part of reporting politics, and I think it's a good way of recruiting people to the process.
We might take one more question, I think. Can I just tell you, tomorrow night, if you go to ABC 2 at 7 o'clock, I think it's 10 past 7, you can see The Daily Show.
No ads.
And it's interesting, Barack Obama's on The Daily Show tomorrow night. So a day before the midterm elections, Barack Obama's decided to... the last interview he'll do is on The Daily Show. I think that's pretty interesting. So we'll take one more question.
Well, I'm afraid it's not a very interesting one. It's not about comedy, but... you mentioned Mr. Hardigan, and earlier in the year he made that speech about journalism. I think I'm not sure if it was him or Mr. Murdoch, but I imagine they're in the same school of thought. He said that the only true guarantee of independent journalism is commercial journalism. And you've just crossed to the public broadcaster. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's rubbish and entirely explicable by commercial purpose. Look, I think that John Hardigan is a terrific inspirational figure for journalism in this country, because he's optimistic about it having a future, and the more people that say that, the more helpful I think it is. However, I think that public broadcasting is at the heart of accountable journalism. I mean, I don't think that anybody apart from a giant mogul seeking to make a buck out of the audience that's left behind would say anything to the contrary.
Wonderful.
Eric Beecher might. Yes, he might. And he did quite recently.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think you agree with me that in the last hour we've been entertained and provoked and given lots of food for thought about the future of journalism and what that future might look like. That's the point of these A.N. Smith lectures. that's the role of the Centre for Advanced Journalism, which I am lucky enough to be the director of. I had particular pleasure tonight to be able to sit there and listen to Annabelle, because I am going to take credit for this. I did hire her and always knew that she was going to be one of the great Australian journalists. She can do anything. She can make speeches. She can do 140 character tweets. She can write books of 150,000 words. She can write quarterly essays, which I think the Malcolm Turnbull essay was as good as any quarterly essay that they've published. I did write a response to that essay and said that Malcolm Turnbull will never be Prime Minister of Australia, having read the essay. I'm not yet been proved right, but I think I'm heading in the right direction. But really, She's incredibly talented. I think that it's been a pleasure to hear you tonight, Annabelle, and thanks for doing it.
Thank you. Thank you.